From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Los Angeles parents are bracing for a possible strike of public school teachers on Monday. Negotiations continue between the L.A. Unified School District and the union. UTLA announced this week if there's no deal, teachers will be on picket lines Monday. That puts parents in a difficult spot, even if they have options other than sending their kids to school. We'll hear from parents after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California. If you are downslope from some of our major fire areas, we wish you all the best this weekend with some heavier rain that's anticipated than we've had so far this rainy season, and we hope all goes well in your community. Coming up, the American Psychological Association has issued new guidelines for treating men and boys. And those guidelines are loaded with controversy. They identify a so-called masculinity ideology, claiming that that ideology is psychologically harmful. We'll debate the concept right after the news. But first, Los Angeles teachers are poised to strike on Monday, setting up picket lines at all LAUSD schools if an agreement isn't reached in negotiations today and potentially over the weekend. With us is KPECC education reporter Kyle Stokes to update us on the latest. Kyle, good morning.
Morning, Larry.
So these are the highest stake negotiations so far, of course, with a strike looming on Monday. Do we have any sorts of indications as to whether progress has been made on any of the issues of dispute?
Well, the two teams, when they met on, I believe it was Wednesday at this point, the days are starting to run together. You'll have to forgive me. But when they last met, there was not much progress. But this was before the governor released his new budget proposal. And that budget proposal included a lot of new money, ongoing money, that sort of raises the floor of funding that school districts can count on year over year. And that, you know, might be a big, you know, kind of change in basic working conditions here at this point, because what happened not long after the budget proposal was unveiled, the superintendent Austin Buettner came out and said, we are going to come back with a new revised offer to UTLA for negotiations that are set to begin today between UTLA and LAUSD this afternoon. So the governor's budget may actually help, you know, unstick these stuck negotiations. Now, we don't know what is in that proposal. We know it's going to involve class size, which has been the biggest sticking point so far. But the budget, you know, the fact that there's going to be more ongoing revenue for LAUSD, it might make a big difference.
Well, and is it possible, and I'm asking you to really speculate here, Kyle, but you could have a contingency deal. In other words, if those additional dollars were passed in the final budget, that X percentage would go to the teachers' demands, but that the district wouldn't be on the hook for that if those dollars didn't make it into the past budget.
I mean, I can imagine that being a, you know, part of the discussion. However, you know, I do think that it's the effect of just the governor's budget proposal is bigger than that. I mean, the way that school districts plan out their budgets is that they do a couple of different check-ins at every single point of the year. We've talked a lot about this almost $2 billion that LAUSD has in the bank. It's a major UTLA talking point, and their point is, well, why don't you just start spending this money? That number comes out of, you know, the most recent check-in, which happened in December. Another check-in happens in March based on the governor's budget proposal. Those numbers become the basis for the district's budget planning all across California. It's called the second interim report. Now that changes the projections of deficit versus surplus that Superintendent Austin Buettner has obviously been very focused on, very concerned about the fact that the district might not be able to make the, you know, kind of end that the third year out, you know, 3 years from now, end it with a surplus. And so, yeah, like there could be a contingency if the money doesn't come through, but this is also a...
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Los Angeles parents are bracing for a possible strike of public school teachers on Monday. Negotiations continue between the LA Unified School District and the union. UTLA announced this week if there's no deal, teachers will be on picket lines Monday. That puts parents in a difficult spot, even if they have options other than sending their kids to school. We'll hear from parents after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California. If you are downslope from some of our major fire areas, we wish you all the best this weekend with some heavier rain that's anticipated than we've had so far this rainy season. And we hope all goes well in your community. Coming up, the American Psychological Association has issued new guidelines for treating men and boys. And those guidelines are loaded with controversy. They've identified a so-called masculinity ideology, claiming that that ideology is psychologically harmful. We'll debate the concept right after the news. But first, Los Angeles teachers are poised to strike on Monday, setting up picket lines at all LAUSD schools if an agreement isn't reached in negotiations today and potentially over the weekend. With us is KPECC education reporter Kyle Stokes to update us on the latest. Kyle, good morning.
Morning, Larry.
So these are the highest stake negotiations so far, of course, with a strike looming on Monday. Do we have any sorts of indications as to whether progress has been made on any of the issues of dispute?
Well, the two teams, when they met on, I believe it was Wednesday at this point, the days are starting to run together. You'll have to forgive me. But when they last met, there was not much progress. But this was before the governor released his new budget proposal. And that budget proposal included a lot of new money, ongoing money that sort of raises the floor of funding that school districts can count on year over year. And that, you know, might be a big, you know, kind of change in basic working conditions here at this point, because what happened not long after the budget proposal was unveiled, Superintendent Austin Buettner came out and said, we are going to come back with a new revised offer to UTLA for negotiations that are set to begin today between UTLA and LAUSD this afternoon. So the governor's budget may actually help, you know, unstick these stuck negotiations. Now, we don't know what is in that proposal. We know it's going to involve class size, which has been the biggest sticking point so far. But the budget, you know, the fact that there's going to be more ongoing revenue for LAUSD, it might make a big difference.
Well, and is it possible, and I'm asking you to really speculate here, Kyle, but you could have a contingency deal. In other words, if those additional dollars were passed in the final budget, that X percentage would go to the teachers' demands, but that the district wouldn't be on the hook for that if those dollars didn't make it into the past budget.
I mean, I can imagine that being a, you know, part of the discussion. However, you know, I do think that it's the effect of just the governor's budget proposal is bigger than that. I mean, the way that school districts plan out their budgets is that they do a couple of different check-ins at every single point of the year. We've talked a lot about this $2 billion, almost $2 billion that LAUSD has in the bank. It's a major UTLA talking point, and their point is, well, why don't you just start spending this money? That number comes out of, you know, the most recent check-in, which happened in December. Another check-in happens in March based on the governor's budget proposal. Those numbers become the basis for the district's budget planning all across California. It's called the second interim report. Now, that changes the projections of deficit versus surplus that Superintendent Austin Buettner has obviously been very focused on, very concerned about the fact that the district might not be able to make the, you know, kind of end that the third year out, you know, 3 years from now, end it with a surplus. And so, yeah, like there could be a contingency if the money doesn't come through. But this is also a state legislature that appears ready to spend a lot of money. And it changes the basic assumptions that the district is making about where it's going to stand, its basic financial forecasts. And that makes a concrete difference, even though it's just a proposal from the governor.
We're talking with KPECC, K-12 education reporter, Kyle Stoke. Now, I'd like to hear from you. If you're a parent of an LA Unified student, what are your plans for Monday? And, for example, if you are going to send your child or children to school on Monday, even if there is a strike, what are you going to be looking for in their report back about their school day to determine whether you would send them back to school Tuesday should the strike continue if there is a strike? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Not all parents, obviously, have access to other child care options to be able to keep their kids out of school and might well be sending their kids to school simply as a matter of having someone to be able to keep an eye on them. But my question for you is, what are you anticipating doing? Who is going to provide the care if your children are going to be home? This is particularly an issue for younger kids who wouldn't be able to be on their own at home during the day. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, and let us know what you think. You can also tweet at AirTalk. We'll be looking for your tweets as well. Now, Kyle, the L.A. County Office of Education came out with a warning a couple of days ago. You've reported on this. How does that factor into the negotiations?
Well, so the L.A. County Office of Education came out and decided to put a fiscal expert in place to help the district write up a cost-cutting plan. Now, at the time, this seemed really serious because this was, you know, this is sort of the first, you know, rung on the ladder of interventions that the county, as the LAUSD's regulator in lieu of the state, has to take if they feel like the district's finances are really becoming unsustainable and the level of crisis is growing beyond the district's control. And higher rungs on that ladder involve things that are kind of like basically a county takeover, where they appoint officials that can, you know, invalidate the school board's decisions and overturn budgets and all of that kind of stuff. You know, I should just, you know, bracket in here that the union has really had a lot of mistrust of LACO's involvement in this process. What I did was I talked last night with the superintendent, the county superintendent. His name is Deborah Duardo, and she said that, you know, first of all, that there has been no, you know, that the timing of this warning does not, you know, have any bearing on UTLA negotiations, that was not, you know, timed to coincide with any UTLA negotiations, but also that the district needs to watch out on spending one-time funds on things like teacher raises and other ongoing expenses. Well, so now we just talked about the fact that the governor has come out with this new budget that proposes a lot of ongoing, you know, in other words, basically permanent new revenue for the school district, not just for LAUSD, but for K-12 systems across the state. And so I asked Dr. Duardo, does that change things? And she's like, well, you know what, if it comes through, yeah, great. Like, maybe it makes the fiscal expert's problem a lot easier to solve. And I'm not looking for takeovers here. I'm not looking for added problems. The whole, you know, system of sounding this alarm, it sounded because it's part of an early warning system. And so, you know, I think it's like the fact that the governor's budget came in with more revenue, I think sort of turns down the temperature on that situation. But when the news came in, Larry, at the time, I thought this was a really big deal, and it might be the thing that changes UTLA negotiations.
Well, I wonder still, Kyle, about whether the district could kind of look at making the county the bad guy here. So if the district, let's say, you know, provides more funds to meet UTLA's negotiating demands, and that ends up that down the road it puts the district into a financially precarious position, couldn't the county just step in and undo some of what the district does?
That's exactly the risk that you run if you begin to run up these sort of unsustainable expenses. And LAUSD still has a lot of problems that the governor's budget proposal does not solve. I mean, it does not solve the fact that there's declining enrollment in LAUSD. It doesn't solve the fact, although it mitigates to an extent the fact that there are growing pension costs in LAUSD. The governor proposed a one-time payment into the state public employee pension plans for teachers and other public employees. The politics of, like, who's the bad guy here, actually, it's interesting because the teachers union, has suspected throughout this whole process that the county has been trying to give the district some cover to drive a harder deal by that the two sides have, you know, the union has gone so far as to say that there's been collusion between the two sides to try and get the district to try and give the district cover to say, hey, we've got these regulators breathing down our neck. We can't give you teachers all that you're asking for. So I think it's interesting. It seemed the fact of the county reaffirming what Superintendent Austin Buettner has been saying. It's an argument he's made a lot.
Well, and what would the payoff be, Kyle, for the county to make that? What does UTLA say the county would get out of that?
It's not about the they don't say that the county would get something out of that. It would. I mean, and that's a very good point.
Like, I mean, why would they? Yeah. I mean, unless there's something in the county for it, why would they bother to insert themselves into it if it wasn't a legitimate concern about the future finances of the district?
What UTLA would point out is that UTLA sent out a statement, that said that they have serious questions about the independence of the county and whether or not there's sort of an instance of regulatory capture. That would be UTLA's argument. You do make a good point. Like, what is it that the county gets out of it? It's a costly, you know, endeavor to take over a school district. And like I said, Larry, I think at this point, given the circumstances of the governor's budget, I think it's possible that the county's, you know, like, intervention here might be kind of a light.
Okay. We're talking with KPCC K-12 reporter Kyle Stokes. Let's take listener calls. Parents in the LA Unified School District, with a strike imminent on Monday, provided no deal is reached between UTLA and LAUSD, what are you going to do? Mary in Hollywood, what's your plan if there's a strike Monday?
Well, first of all, Larry, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am concerned with crossing picket lines. I do support my teachers. My special education teachers work really hard as far as all the supports for my child. I have a child with an IEP that is it's supposed to be an individual educational plan.
Mm-hmm.
That means that there are supports in place besides the teachers that do deal with him on a daily basis. He has a one-on-one aide that is supposed to be with him. First of all, to prevent any behaviors that may become disruptive to a class or that may impede learning for other learners, there's always been a push from LAUSD that we put our special education students in mainstream. So what does this mean for my child on Monday?
Damn, Mary, have you talked with your child's aide to see if the aide is going to observe the picket line or not?
The aide is not going to observe the picket line. She has her own union, from what I hear. And, so they have chosen, they take a vote, and they voted to not.
Okay. So your child would still have the aide on Monday. Does that tip it in the favor for you of sending your child to school because your child will have the aide?
To be honest with you, I am just sending my child in order to see what LAUSD has in store for this strike that they are putting children at risk, in my opinion, because some of the children, my child is healthy, thank heavens, but some of our special education students that are in class with him have very, very strict and specific needs as far as health care.
Sure.
And the less adults and the less teachers and the less nurses that there are on campus, it's more of a risk.
Well, and Mary, I think the point for many parents of special need kids as well is there isn't necessarily something that they can put together for home care at the last minute to be able to fill that gap should they decide to keep their child home. Mary, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Erica in Woodland Hills, I understand you also have a child who has special needs. What's your plan for Monday?
I 100% support the teachers and their right to strike. I cannot say at this moment whether I will be able to put together a caretaker plan so that my daughter will be able to stay home from school and honor the strike, but what I can tell you for sure is I will be joining the picket line, and I will be bringing my daughter to the picket line if she is on campus.
All right. And have you confirmed that your child's in-class support will be working and would be there Monday even if there's a strike?
I am not aware. I have not been told one way or the other. But the fact of the matter is, I think that the teachers have a very strong case to strike. I think that the whole narrative has been as if to make it the teachers that are doing this to the parents, to the students. That is not the case. With the $2 billion reserve fund, which is unprecedented and historic, certainly there can be money found to pay teachers a living wage so they can stay in the city of Los Angeles where they work.
Erica, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much for voicing support for the teachers should they walk the picket line on Monday, but concerned as well about her daughter with special needs. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Do you have the option of not sending your child to school on Monday? If you do have that option, what is your plan? How are you going to handle it? Or if you do send your child Monday and there is a strike, what feedback are you going to look for from your daughter or son to indicate to you whether you would want to send them back if there's a second day of a strike? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Negotiations continue today between the LA Unified School District and United Teachers Los Angeles, hopes of reaching a deal to avert a strike on Monday, which would see picket lines at LAUSD campuses throughout the district. The district says it'll present a new contract proposal today that takes into account what Governor Gavin Newsom is proposing in increased public education funding for his upcoming fiscal year budget. 866-893-KPECC. Hopefully there will not be any sort of upheaval in district classrooms on Monday, but if there is, how are you planning to deal with it if you have a child who's an LAUSD student? For some parents, there really are no options. They're just not a good home care alternative. There's not extended family. There's not a parent who can be home. There's not money to hire someone to be home with a child who needs to have someone in the home with him or her on Monday. So maybe you're sending your child to school because there's not a viable plan B. If you've got alternatives, how are you going to deal with that? And what are you going to look for early on to determine what you do in the successive days if the strike continues, if there is a strike? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Justine, joining us in Echo Park. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Hi. So what are your plans? I understand you've got a five-year-old in an early education program.
Yes. Yeah, so my daughter, she's five, and she attends our local LAUSD Early Education Center, and they gave us the word the other night that, you know, due to state requirements, they won't be able to stay open. So all of the early education centers and state preschool programs are going to be closed. So we haven't figured it out yet. Me and my co-parent, we're still working it out what next week looks like. We don't have family that doesn't work. Like my mom works, and most everyone in our family works full time. So we're trying to figure out what next week would look like if a strike happens. And I just want to say also that I do believe in what the teachers are striking for. I think there's this really unhealthy fascination with who to blame, and I don't think that's where we need to be. I think we have a responsibility together to work together, whether a strike happens or not. You know, if a strike happens, we're going to have to come back to the table when it's done and work together.
Well, it's interesting, Justine, because what we've heard from our listeners is a tremendous amount of support for the teachers in the impasse. And yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to me. And that's something that I think has been seen in the past when teachers go on strike. That is typically where parental affinity is. That's who parents deal with, are the teachers who they see working very hard on their kids' behalf. That is the emotional connection. And parents also see very clearly the kinds of limitations the teachers have to deal with, the class sizes, the behavioral problems, the challenge in affording, you know, a place to live in a high housing cost area, all those things parents see. So I think it's not surprising that there is affinity for the teacher's position on this. And I'm sure the district is, you know, is very, very aware of that. Back to your situation, though, Justine, I don't know if you've gotten so far as to call around to see if you can line up childcare, but I'm wondering if, you know, childcare professionals are getting swamped by parent requests and if, you know, there are even enough people out there to look after kids Monday.
Unfortunately, I'm not in a situation to do that. I just don't have the money to hire professionals to do that next week.
Yeah.
So I haven't made those calls.
Yeah, well, you're in the position of a lot of people. There's no question about that, having the money available to do it, an unbudgeted high cost like that, high expense, and even the availability of someone that you would trust to look after your little one. Justine, thanks so much. I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Daphne in the Fairfax District, good to have you with us. What are your plans?
So I have three kids. So I'm affected in...
Did you say three kids?
Yes.
Okay. Big effect.
Different schools. The problem lies is that I support my teachers. I support my principal. I support the district. And so supporting all of those, and I have to support my family. So that puts me in such a difficult position because if I don't send my kid to school, my school will lose money. And the teachers are telling me not to send my kids to school, but they don't understand that in the long term, my school's going to hurt, you know?
So let me just clarify, Daphne, did the teachers at your school tell the kids not to go to school?
Yes. My six-year-old, who is now in first grade, came home and said, Mommy, there's no school on Monday. We don't have to go to school. And so I have to try to explain to my six-year-old that, you know, the scenario of what is going on, why school is important. So these kids are now pawns between a sort of fight between all these adults, and these kids have to be in the middle of it. So in the meantime, the principal is saying, nope, you have to come to school to support the school because obviously they get paid per pupil. And if they don't get paid, then the school is then you're going to dig deeper holes. And at the same time, I want to support my individual teacher by standing next to them, saying, I agree with you. Small classes are important. We need a nurse. So I have all of these things that I have to think of, and I have to go to work.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of stress on a parent like yourself, particularly one with three children who are in LAUSD schools. Daphne, I so appreciate your call. Let me go back to KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, have you heard other cases from parents where the teachers told the kids that there's no school Monday or that they shouldn't come to school Monday?
Yeah, I've heard bits and pieces of stories exactly like that. And I would, you know, sort of throw out here that we're talking about teachers trying to translate this situation to very young children, to children like Daphne's. And the message being spread out across more than 25,000 teachers who are a part of UTLA, that are basically tasked with trying to be honest with their kids, and try and relay the news to students with, you know, you've got to deliver that message in age appropriate ways. I have heard that there are teachers saying that there are specifically, you know, that there's going to be no school. And who knows if the teacher isn't saying, well, I'm not going to be here. So, you know, there will be no class in the same way that it normally is held. This is the sort of danger of spreading this message. You know, you've got 25,000 different people who are delivering the message in different age appropriate ways.
Do you know if UTLA has communicated consistent messaging to UTLA members for what they're expected to say to their students?
I'm not aware of what the union is telling the teachers specifically to say. I'd imagine it's varying widely.
That's interesting. And you're aware of the district asking the teachers to give any particular messaging to this? Not that the teachers would feel bound by that, but
the district has sent home letters through the teachers. That was actually a point of contention in negotiations. But the district has been sending home its own messages. And that's sort of, I think, the reason that some teachers are feeling a little bit more free to talk about it is because they were told, don't talk to your kid. The district, you know, requested the teachers not talk about it with their students. And then, you know, Superintendent Buettner sent home a letter, outlining the district's position, essentially. And I think at that point, I think a lot of teachers sort of thought, okay, like, you know, we need to level with our students.
Melanie in Mar Vista, I understand you have a couple of kids in LAUSD schools. What are your plans for Monday if there is a strike?
Hi, Larry. We are not planning to send our kids to school, but it's for slightly different reasons than I think many of the callers have mentioned. We're not sending our children because we don't want them sitting in an auditorium with 400 other kids doing nothing all day. So we're actually planning to just open up our home and let other kids come over if their parents need the help.
And who are you able to stay home, or your partner, or someone taking a day off work, or is there someone available who doesn't work who's able to do this?
Yeah, my husband and I both work freelance and work from home.
So oh, great.
To make that happen, we feel very fortunate.
Yeah, that's nice. And do you have a sense of how many other parents might take you up on your open house offer?
We've spoken to a few. I mean, I think it's more about that, we're trying to create an environment for our kids where they're still able to be with other kids and not just, you know, home alone.
All right. And your thought, I mean, are you going to be supporting the picket line, or what are your plans for relating to your local campus if there's a strike?
Yeah, it's a little isolating because we're actually two parents who, I'll speak for myself and not necessarily my husband, but we are not in support of the strike. I've looked very carefully at the finances, and I find it incredibly frustrating to not hear any mention of the looming financial crisis. There's a little bit of a mention, but it's not really addressed.
So you feel like a strike would not be justified?
I don't. I have a problem with the fact that our teachers are offered lifetime benefits. I have a problem with the fact that there's no mention that down the line, our school district is going to go bankrupt and be taken over if we don't address these problems that were kicked down the path by our former president of our school board, and they're not being addressed. And
all right.
I feel like it's going to keep happening, and it's not going to be addressed.
Melanie, I appreciate your call, and of course, the union, you know, sees it differently in terms of the money and that reserve. But I appreciate you sharing your perspective and what your plans are to do with you and your husband able to do it, given that you work freelance at home. Maria in Highland Park says the junior high principal at my child's school said he got a notice from Superintendent Buettner to tell parents if their kids don't go to school, they will be marked as truant. Kyle Stokes, real quickly, has that been communicated? Truant? Because I would think they would be marked as absent, right? Because you can't bill the state for their attendance.
I can't verify that statement is something that I've heard about or is true. I think technically the answer is yes, but I would just – I don't know think that there's some security and obscurity if parents are scared worried about truancy and in keeping your kids home. That's sort of, I think, the calculation there.
Manuela in East Los Angeles called and spoke with one of our call screeners in Spanish. Translated, she said, I'm a parent of 5 students and completely support the teachers. The teachers aren't asking just for salary. They're asking for class size improvement, for nurses and counselors available at all times. I will gladly be keeping my kids home because I think our children deserve a much better education. Yvette in Mid-City says, if there's a strike Monday, my son will be with a babysitter, won't go to school. He's 10. And Tina in Westwood says, I'm a mother of 3 LAUSD special education students. I will honor the strike. I'm a staff member at Cal State Northridge, and some of my Northridge students will support the strike for the teacher's perspective. Tina, thank you very much for that. And share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll take a look at the American Psychological Association's guidelines for therapists working with men and boys and what it says about a particular type of masculinity. It's controversial. We'll discuss it coming up right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up on Film Week, our critics will tell us about the new comedic drama starring Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston. Also, Nicole Kidman, The Upside, directed by Neil Berger. A Dog's Way Home, a family film starring Bryce Dallas Howard and Ashley Judd. Charles Martin Smith directs the movie. And Replicas, which is an international co-production, a sci-fi mystery film starring Keanu Reeves and Alice Eve. Replicas. Those films to be reviewed coming up. Plus, we talk with Pete Docter and Charles Solomon. Animation, the focus. Pete, of course, is the head of Pixar Animation. We're going to talk with him about what's going on at Pixar, as well as a tribute to be paid to a great Japanese animator, and we'll talk about that coming up. But first, we turn our attention to American Psychological Association guidelines for working with men and boys. These guidelines are first ever. I think they've been more than a decade in the works to come out with them. But there's some controversial recommendations that are including the ways that they look at aspects of traditional masculinity. Joining me, a gentleman who helped to draft the guidelines, University of Redlands professor and psychologist Frederick Rabinowitz. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So let's start first of all about sort of how masculinity is treated here, because we hear this term toxic masculinity. We hear masculinity talked about in negative ways that we don't necessarily hear femininity talked about negatively. So how did you sort of parse even the term?
Well, it's interesting because traditional masculinity is a term that's used professionally to really talk about the way that boys and men are socialized. So in contrast to girls and women, boys and men are often feel like they have to prove their manhood. So the more traditional version of this script is to be strong, tough, self-reliant, not show emotional vulnerability. Well, that's good and appropriate in certain situations like a war zone or when under threat. It's actually limiting and can be damaging when it's taken to extremes. Research shows that men who endorse these traits at high levels across situations tend to not seek help, are less likely to get checkups, cancer screenings, are less likely to let others know of their internal conflicts and emotional pain, and are more at risk for using violence against self and others. The suicide rate for men is 4 times that of women, even though in studies it shows that women seem to endorse more depression symptoms.
Now, I guess if we were talking about women, for example, we probably wouldn't use the term toxic femininity for a woman who feels disempowered and is you know, comparatively meek or submissive or, you know, certain things that are thought of as extreme examples of traditional femininity, perhaps. Why would we invoke the term masculinity to describe what are negative, psychologically negative manifestations? We wouldn't do that with women, though. We would talk specifically about the behaviors or the feelings. We wouldn't label it as femininity.
Right. I think it's a historical concept. You know, a lot of the early psychological work, in fact, all the way up into the 70s, was done normatively on men and boys as the norm, and usually it was white heterosexual men and boys, was considered the norm. And what's happened is, as we've done more and more research, there are so many other factors that are impacting the male experience, including the fact that women are now considered equal in almost all aspects. And so men have had the traditional role has been for men to be in charge and in power. And I think that's part of the backlash and reactivity to the idea.
So does masculinity as a concept then, in your view, have any kind of a healthy place? And if it does, what then are the things that differentiate it from healthy femininity?
Well, I think we could probably say that there are healthy characteristics like being able to be a good father or have good interpersonal relationships or be a good leader or be able to listen to others. I think all of those are things that probably both men and women, masculinity and femininity, would say are really positive. And I think there are, you know, typically in the past, men have been the ones to go fight wars. They are the majority of firefighters and policemen, you know. And so in a sense, we've elevated that type of masculinity, which is very protective, in our culture. And I think that part of this is just a recalibrating and saying, you know, race and culture and age and economic and ability status and sexual orientation, those are all interacting and intersecting with what it means to be a man. And so I think it's just, you know, the words that are used, I think oftentimes when you say traditional, I think people are thinking, you know, that somehow we're trashing traditional values. And that's not what this is about. This is just looking at that schema, that script, and saying, can we make it more flexible? Can we enhance the toolbox that boys and men have in terms of adapting to the world?
All right. We're talking with the University of Redlands Professor Frederick Rabinowitz, a psychologist. He co-authored the guidelines that have been released by the American Psychological Association on working with men and boys. He was actually the president of the APA's Society for the Psychological Study of Men and Masculinity. I'd like to hear from you as an AirTalk listener what you think about this, the notion that traditional masculinity and a number of other aspects that Dr. Rabinowitz just mentioned, seeing those as negative and in need of addressing with some clients who are men and boys, clients of psychologists and other mental health professionals. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me from McGill University in Montreal, Canada, Samuel Vessier, who is assistant professor of psychiatry and anthropology and co-directs McGill's Culture, Mind, and Brain program. Professor Vessière, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
What are your concerns about these guidelines?
Oh boy, we have a lot to talk about. But first, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's lots of positive aspects to these guidelines before getting into the controversy. So I'd be happy to talk a bit about the both promising and problematic aspects of the guidelines from the perspective of evolutionary anthropology and cultural psychiatry. So first, it's important to acknowledge that the guidelines are timely, that they seem very sincere, very well-intentioned and empathetic, perhaps not very compassionate, maybe we'll get into that later, but that they certainly attempt to offer nuanced understanding of men and boys' issues. So what's interesting, for example, is the recognition that masculinity, it's a very multifaceted construct that means different things to different people and groups, and as such that it'll be enacted, experienced, perceived, and valued in very different ways. The other really timely, really important, interesting dimension is, well, the recognition that men and boys face really distinct and often ignored health challenges like higher mortality and suicidality, but also harsher punishments, higher likelihood not to seek help or treatment, and higher likelihood to suffer from certain conditions like ADHD, conduct disorders, addictions of all kinds, but also, and these are not mentioned in the guidelines, things like intellectual disabilities, autism, and basically most forms of mental illness, except for depression and anxiety. So we can return to those later. But from the perspective of a more biologically minded scholar, no one will disagree that these higher rates exist, but some might disagree on the causes. Now, speaking to the more problematic dimensions of the guidelines, I would say there are three dimensions that concern me, and there are pragmatic dimensions, scientific dimensions, and then ethical ones. So first and foremost, I think there are pragmatic problems because the guidelines, however sincere and well-meaning they are unlikely to achieve the goal of better treatment for boys simply because they're going to upset a lot of people because of the very polarizing language, or language that is likely to polarize due to its reliance on basically ideas and models that are taken from a very socio-constructivist view that, although it is not intended as such, it's probably going to be interpreted as anti-traditionalist and even anti-masculine.
Okay. So that's the pragmatic. And what was the second one you mentioned?
The second one is sort of scientific. I think despite the attempt at nuance, the guidelines in the end settle for a model of traditional masculinity that's quite simplistic and unified and that relies almost exclusively on these sociological, feminist, and well, you could call them intersectional views that seem to ignore a lot of biology and evolution on the one hand, and also on the other hand, from a more anthropological perspective, the many ways in which different kinds of traditional masculine gender roles across cultures do offer a meaningful, protective, and complementary framework for raising healthy boys and girls.
All right. And we'll come back to your third in a moment. You're listening to AIR Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're debating the guidelines of the American Psychological Association for working with men and boys. The subject, masculinity and traditional masculinity. What does that mean? We're at 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Film Week coming up in just a few minutes with our critics. I invite you to stay tuned for that. We'll also talk about, in addition to the week's reviews, Miyazaki, the great Japanese animator. We'll talk about his influence on animators around the world. Right now, our focus is on the notion of traditional masculinity. What does that mean? And the new guidelines from the American Psychological Association on how to work with men and boys on the notion of masculinity. We're talking with psychiatrist, anthropologist Samuel Vessière of McGill University in Montreal. Professor, and then you were going to say a third issue before we broke, that concerns you about the new guidelines.
Right. So I think the mention that anti-femininity is an aspect of traditional masculinity is something that has upset a lot of people. For me, that's not the chiefest concern. I think if you look at many men who identify as traditionally masculine, you can easily show that most men basically adore as opposed to hate women. The biggest problem is more the fundamental misunderstanding of sort of the importance of self-sacrifice and stoicism, which is also often seen as a key aspect of masculinity. So stoicism, briefly, when properly understood, I think it offers a really good way to understand and deal with complex emotions, whereas in the guidelines, the understanding is that men are just not in touch with their emotions enough. So stoicism, which is also, I guess, a philosophical principle that informs cognitive behavioral therapy, but also, you know, mindfulness interventions and even Buddhism, the basic understanding is that it's not so much events in themselves that affect people, but how people interpret events and assign meaning to those events. So my concern is that in basically pathologizing what you could call stoic or what I would call self-regulating strategies, men are being encouraged to externalize a little too much. So, for example, say I'm suicidal because of oppression or because of patriarchy or because other people, you know, make me. And this kind of external locus of control is basically clinically disastrous. It's associated with all kinds of adverse outcomes like low coping and recovery, rumination, poor social relationships, and fragility in general. So that's really my biggest...
Okay. And going back to your contention about, I just want to clarify on stoicism, are you saying your concern is that stoicism is kind of being lumped in with emotional avoidance, that they're two different things? Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, I think there's a popular misconception about stoicism that where the claim is understood as just tough it out and suppress your emotions, but the philosophy of stoicism, which as I mentioned again informs cognitive behavioral therapy, is rather a way to become more attentive to our emotion and to learn also how to not be driven by basic emotions like fear and anger sometimes. So for many people, what you could call stoicism is the road to better emotional literacy, and it's a little unfortunate to pathologize that as part of the masculinity package.
Michael in Highland Park, your thoughts about these new APA guidelines?
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear this conversation. I grew up in rural Nebraska in the 1980s, and I'm a gay man. I came out, you know, in 1992. But when I was younger, I was just surrounded by men who were traditionally, I guess, masculine, and any sort of femininity that I brought out was definitely told to tamp down and to not have presenting at all. When I did come out, that sort of carried with me, and I definitely tried to date, you know, more masculine men and tried to present more masculine. And then I really had a sort of epiphany about being that femininity or softness is an okay thing. And I just was thinking about how this relates to women and being, you know, told what to do from an early age.
Michael, I really appreciate it. It makes very concrete what you're talking about. Professor Rabinowitz, you want to respond to that?
Sure. I just think I actually agree that there, you know, mindfulness is one of the strategies that men can use to you know, deal with strong emotion. I think that what we're just saying is to be aware that many men are seeing the world through this filter, and to expose the filter and say, is this the time, is this the place for me to enact this kind of masculinity, or is this a time where I need to sit back and be less reactive or be more communicative? So I actually am not disagreeing with this. I'm just saying that we're trying to help people be aware that there is a filter that is happening that is interfering with healthy functioning.
You know, and in Michael's case, where he's talking about there's this negative judgment for not being traditionally masculine enough, that almost seems to me like a sort of a separate issue, and that is where men are forced to be a particular way, forced to be masculine, or ridiculed for being more feminine, as their gender is supposed to be determinant of whether they're masculine and feminine. And is that addressed in the guidelines, Professor?
Yes, I think so. I think that what we're saying is that, yes, there are biological differences necessarily between men and women, but they're not the destiny for a man. That in this case, you know, sometimes men have, they look around, they see what they're, they know what they're experiencing inside, they look around them, and they try to get some mirroring. And in our culture, and especially maybe in Nebraska, you know, the culture says, be a man, and so your internal state doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of what we're trying to do is to say, let's go inside. Let's not just take the surface level.
We are too soon out of time. I'm sorry to cut. We're going to return to this topic. This has been a great conversation. Gentlemen, thank you. Film Week is next.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. And I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com. She has a brand new podcast she co-hosts called Breakfast All Day. You can get it at your favorite podcast sites. Tim Cogshell, film critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. And Charles Solomon, who has a big presence today. He's with Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. He's not only reviewing with us, but Charles joins me along with Pixar's Pete Docter later this hour. We talk about the great Japanese animator Miyazaki, as well as what's going on in Pixar with their busy production slate. But we begin with the comedic drama The Upside, starring Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston, and Nicole Kidman. The film is based on the movie The Untouchables. Neil Berger directs this remake. John Hartmere wrote the screenplay. At its core, it's a relationship between a wealthy man who's quadriplegic and an unemployed man with a criminal record hired to help him.
You are not qualified for this position.
Have you ever changed a catheter?
No.
Pinch the head, insert.
I can't feel it.
Oh, well, I can.
The Upside, it's rated PG-13. Christy, what'd you think?
This is, yeah, as you say, it's a remake of a French film and a film that was a huge hit in France and it burst all kinds of box office records. And when I was watching it, the original French film, I knew immediately someone somewhere is going to remake this in English with big Hollywood stars.
And took a few years.
Yeah, well, it played at Toronto a year and a half ago, but got caught up in all the Harvey Weinstein stuff, and that's why it's out now. But it is trying to cash in on that same charming, inspiring true story and just falls flat, never achieves that same level of sly charm. You have Kevin Hart here as sort of a version of the character that Kevin Hart plays a lot. He's streetwise and fast-talking and kind of roguish and kind of charming. He plays an ex-con who just basically needs to show that he has been looking for a job. All he needs is signatures from possible employers to show that he has tried. He stumbles into the elevator of this Park Avenue penthouse belonging to Bryan Cranston, who is quadriplegic after a horrific parasailing accident, and he is in a wheelchair and requires 24-hour care. Kevin Hart's character is like the only one who does not condescend to him. He's the only one who has attitude and an edge to him, and is totally unqualified. And so Bryan Cranston's character says, "You're hired." And it is kind of a standard feel-good, fish-out-of-water, mismatched buddy comedy where the white guy learns to loosen up by smoking pot. And the black
because
guy,
you do.
Yeah, and the black guy learns about the finer things in life like opera and modern art. And each of these guys is such a pro, each of these actors, and they're really giving it their all, but they don't have much to do beyond just the facile types they have been given to work with.
And is it very close to the French original?
Yes.
Okay. So even though Kevin Hart kind of has his own special talents, he's still essentially in line with how that character
well,
was played.
Well,
there's,
yes
a, there's,
and no.
there's a difference, right? Yeah. In the French original, he's an immigrant. And that's sort of like the issue that he's a, you know, sort of an illegal immigrant. I suppose to hear, you know, Cameron, he's not an immigrant. He lives
in the Bronx and he's poor, but he's American.
Yeah, but he's but, you know, there's really not that much of a distance between them except for their socioeconomic status. What I do like about this movie is Kevin Hart. He only stops once or twice to do those little routines the way that comedians often do in these films, you know. He only does it once or twice. I think he made a good choice in this movie. He's playing this character angry. He's chosen to play this guy as mad, and it gives him a place to go, room to move, and that's the reason why Bryan Cranston's character likes him. Because Bryan Cranston's character is mad too, but he doesn't know how to express being angry. And that little guy over there, he can be mad for me, and that's kind of an interesting thing going on in the movie. Does it work? No, not really. You know, they've done this film a few other times. Argentine Spanish language one called The Inseparables. There's one called Impuri that's in Tagalog. And there's a Bollywood one that's in development right now. So it's a universal story that people love, this sort of idea about how the rich and the young can manage to live together. I wish it were a little bit better, but Kevin Hart is good at it.
They never have the kind of chemistry that they had in the original film, though. Yeah. And I want to mention, Nicole Kidman gets absolutely nothing to play. She is stuck in this one-note character where she's just the uptight, disapproving executive who does not want Bryan Cranston to hire this guy and has her eye on him. And is looking for ways to fire him. She kind of loosens up slightly because she has to get up and dance at one point. But this is just tepid and facile and cliched.
The Upside, rated PG-13 in wide release. Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston, Nicole Kidman, Neil Berger directed. John Hartmere wrote the screenplay. The family film A Dog's Way Home, an adventure based on W. Bruce Cameron's book, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Catherine Michon. Charles Martin Smith directs. Bryce Dallas Howard stars as the voice of Bella, a dog separated from her owner who has to figure out how to get back home.
Life with Lucas was the best, but when he wasn't around, I missed him so much. It's that squirrel again. Squirrel, squirrel, squirrel!
Bella!
I was very far from home, but I knew Lucas was waiting for me.
Charles Martin Smith has directed a number of family adventure films like A Dog's Way Home. Christy, what'd you think of this one?
So this isn't really exactly a remake or a sequel of A Dog's Purpose from 2 years ago, but it is the same author who wrote both books both these films are based on. And in both films, you have sort of an episodic structure where this dog is going from one person to the next to the next to the next. And we learn life lessons along the way, and everyone's better for having spent time with the dog. And in both films, you have an actor doing wall-to-wall narration, spelling out every single thing this dog is thinking, right? So in the first film, you had
stupid,
right? That's exactly it. In the first film, you had Josh Gad. Here, you have Bryce Dallas Howard, and that clip we just played is a really good example of how what she is saying in her voiceover never ever illuminates us at all as to what is going on with the dog. Like, we could infer that the dog is cold because it's out in the rain in the cold and is trembling. Like, it's Lassie didn't have to explain herself ever. And we understood, okay, this is a treacherous situation. I have to assume that the wall-to-wall narration is for really little kids because it's super cutesy, like over-the-top adorable cutesy. So that, I guess, is to help, you know, hold hands of little kids who are watching it. Having said that, a lot of really traumatic stuff happens in this film. You see this dog, Bella, getting mauled by a bunch of wolves out in the wilderness. Man. Right. Bella witnesses a cougar being killed by hunters, and then Bella becomes sort of like the mama dog to the cougar kitten. I mean, awful things happen that are scary and traumatic, and the dog almost dies over and over again. This is not a spoiler. Eventually, the dog has to go home. There is a nice subplot here, I will say, though, with how Bella becomes a therapy dog for several veterans at the VA, and that's a nice role for her, and they need her, and she needs them. And so there is something worthwhile. There's a nugget of something worthwhile in here. But it's just a weird mishmash of stuff, and I did not cry enough. I should be sobbing. I should be sobbing from word one, and I didn't really cry till the absolute end. So that's my standard. Leave me in a puddle. That's what I want.
A dog's way. Not that kind of puddle.
No.
A Dog's Way Home, rated PG. It's in wide release, starring the voice of Bryce Dallas Howard with Ashley Judd, Jonah Howard King in the cast as well. Replicas, a sci-fi mystery written by Chad St. John, directed by Jeffrey Nachmanoff. Keanu Reeves and Alice Eve star about a scientist whose wife and children are killed in an accident and the lengths to which humanity will go to achieve immortality.
William, something's not right with me. Tell me the truth.
There was a crash.
Replicas. Tim?
Oh, boy. Went to see this movie late last night because they didn't screen it for critics because,
it seems
you know.
Appropriate, though, Tim. A late night.
Which was kind of okay. I'm in this theater, and there are about 25 people in there. And it was dark. I couldn't see. But I'm pretty sure everybody in there was over 50. And it's because of Keanu Reeves. And we have this thing. We can't help ourselves. He's our guy. He's our guy. Even when he makes these stupid movies, he's our guy. And this big, dumb movie is one that he's in. Jeff and Chad. Chad St. John wrote this movie. Chad wrote London Has Fallen. It was a big, dumb movie. Peppermint, which is a big, dumb movie, and a few other big, dumb movies. And Jeff wrote A Day After Tomorrow, which is a big... These guys, just this is what they do. It's actually literally what
well,
they do.
Well, there is an audience for those films.
The 50 of us, 25 of us were sitting there watching last night. So, yeah, this is really terrible. And the idea, though, this high concept sort of idea. You got this one guy who's working on moving minds, intelligence from human brains into robotic brains, right? He keeps failing. Got this other guy who's working on cloning. A terrible thing happens, as they say in the thing. The cloning guy, played by Thomas Middleditch, who has never, ever, ever successfully cloned anything, has to figure out a way to clone Keanu Reeves' whole family. Got to do it tonight, by the way. Got to do it tonight.
He works best under pressure.
Under pressure. They work at this Biodyne laboratory, big laboratory, yet they walk out of this laboratory with like $6 million worth of stuff, and they put it in Keanu Reeves' garage where he grows his wife and kids. And by the way, all of this work is actually being done by Thomas Middleditch, because in the whole movie, all Keanu Reeves keeps saying is, I can't do it, man. I can't do it. You got to do it for me, man. And I'm like, okay. I'm sorry. Go on, Christy.
No, this movie is terrible. This movie is terrible, but enjoyably so. Mm. Like, I'm really glad I saw it. This is a nutty movie, but it's almost not nutty enough sometimes, right? I want full Keanu.
If you're going to do it, crank it up to 11.
I want Nicolas Cage in this role. Like, Keanu is too sedate for this. I laughed out loud a lot. At times, I'm not sure it meant for me to.
No.
Having said that, it also tries to be funny, Tim, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it tries to be wacky.
It shouldn't be doing
with
that.
With cloning.
You can't look wacky cloning.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a moment in this movie that ought to be heart-wrenching.
Oops, you had two heads in
choose,
that version. Try again.
Which would happen to all of his other clones. But he cloned his family perfectly. Not
17 days, by the way, is the appropriate amount of time for cloning. You go a little bit longer, they might have two heads.
And
you
in
you
the
don't
garage.
Know.
That's yeah.
right.
nice. You can multipurpose.
Also, it's in Puerto Rico, but it's got to be like pre-hurricane Puerto Rico because everything looks really nice.
Well, it's because the tax credit was in Puerto Rico. That's why it's in Puerto Rico.
That's why they're there. Anyway, it's fun. It's a good, dumb, fun movie.
Replicas in wide release starring Keanu Reeves and Alice Eve. Jeffrey Nachmanoff, the director, rated PG-13. Sergeant Will Gardner, an action-adventure film starring Max Martini and Omari Hardwick, written and directed by Martini Christie.
So this is a movie I feel very conflicted about because it really means well, and it's a really important topic, but it is told in a frustratingly kind of ham-fisted, flag-waving, kind of cliched, overwhelming way. So Max Martini wrote, directed, co-produced, and stars in this as an Iraq War veteran named Will Gardner. And he comes back, and he is struggling to reinsert himself into society and have a life again. But he's understandably suffering from PTSD, and he suffered some brain injuries. He has lost his best friend, which haunts him. And it's about how he goes on this cross-country journey on a stolen motorcycle to rediscover himself, to reconnect with his wife and his son. And there's a lot of like American flag waving and country music playing in the background. And it's kind of painfully hitting you over the head with notions of patriotism. But having said that, there are some lovely, subtle moments here and there. He has a nice exchange with Gary Sinise, who is a bartender at a dive bar in New Mexico that he hits along the way. Once he does reconnect with his ex-wife, played by Elizabeth Rome, there's a really lovely moment, a great monologue that she gets, you know, expressing how she felt when he was gone and how scared she was. He's giving it his all, Max Martini, physically and emotionally, but there's a lot of kind of cringy stuff here. I feel conflicted. I feel bad trashing it because it really, it's important and it means well. It's an important message to get out there.
Nothing worse than a movie that means well. Max, who is a noted actor whose face you would know, he's on NCIS Los Angeles right now. Here he has this big gigantic red beard, and he's modulating his voice in this very sort of Sam Elliott sort of specific sort of way. It's different than his own. It's very ruha, you know, this movie. Big speeches about a veteran and what it means and all this kind of stuff. As a veteran, I feel like I can say that I hate that. And if this movie had not done that, if about half of the dialogue that comes out of his mouth stayed inside his head, this movie would probably be okay. Omari Hardwick actually doing a pretty good job here.
It spells a lot out. And then there's a whole unfortunate subplot where Lily Rabe thinks that he's Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
It's not funny.
Sergeant Will Gardner, the action-adventure film starring Max Martini, who wrote and directed as well. It's unrated at the AMC Burbank Town Center. We have many more films to talk about with our critics, and then Charles stays around as we talk with Pete Docter of Pixar about what's going on with their animation. Back in a minute. I haven't had a chance to check where we are on ticket sales for our upcoming Film Week Academy Awards preview, but I do know we sold out last year, and I'd like you to get your tickets while there's still time. It's Sunday, February 17th, that afternoon at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We're back there at the beautiful historic theater on South Broadway. All of our Film Week critics will be there, including the three who joined me today. Sunday afternoon, February 17th at 1 o'clock, we'll see the clips of all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures, a chance for some members of the audience to ask questions of our critics. You always get great, insightful questions from those that attend the event. Tickets are at kpecc.org/in-person. I hope to see you Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel. Our critics joining us this week, Charles Solomon, Animation Authority, Tim Cogshell, and Christy Lemire. Next up is the animated film from Japan, Modest Heroes, Ponoc Short Films Theater, Volume 1. Charles, that's a bit of an unusual title.
Yes. Well, when Miyazaki announced his retirement in 2016, Ghibli cut way back on their staffing, and a lot of the artists went to a studio a veteran had started called Studio Ponoc. And they very quickly did Mary and the Witch's Flower, very, very polished first film, a little bit close to Ghibli in its look, but a good, solid feature. And so to try and develop new talent and explore some more styles, Nishimura, who's the head of the studio, commissioned these three films from his audience, from his artists. So there are three shorts that all deal with the idea of heroism in everyday life. And I particularly liked one called Life Ain't Gonna Lose. That's about an elementary school boy with a very serious allergy to eggs who inadvertently gets some in ice cream and has to, you know, deal with the problems. He's a very winning little kid. It's something we would never do in an animated feature. Similarly, Invisible Man, Invisible is about a man who is invisible and really explores the alienation of someone who is just not seen by society, literally, and it becomes kind of a metaphor for rejects, who's finally willing to sacrifice himself to save a child that's in danger from an accident. And then Yonebayashi, who directed Mary and the Witch's Flower in two films at Ghibli, does one about two children who are actually the embodiment of freshwater crab spirits. They're these little underwater characters who have to learn to look out for each other when their father is swept away by the current. They're very different. They're very charming. The one sad note is it was originally going to be four films. Isao Takahata had agreed to do one, and then he died last year and wasn't able to. But it's also just very encouraging to see a studio saying, okay, even if there isn't a huge amount of money in this, let's see about developing our talent. Let's see what visuals we can work with. Let's see what kinds of stories we can do. And just putting out these little short films, and they have plans to keep doing them. So I really enjoyed them and would recommend them.
And sounds like something to support, too. I mean,
yes.
If you really want to support creativity in animated filmmaking, this is a way to do it.
Yeah, well, it would also be nice if there were some similar things for live-action filmmakers here.
Yeah.
That, again, would let younger artists try new and different things, and we might get better full features as a result.
Yeah, that aren't just sort of calling card shorts.
Yes.
Modest Heroes, Ponoc Short Films Theater, Volume 1, Japanese Animated Films, and it's Saturday only that this is in selected theaters. So Saturday is your only chance to see it. The films are rated PG. And it, Charles, sounds like, I mean, this is for all ages?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't take very small children to it, but later elementary school, junior high, fine. There, and I think particularly the one about the boy with the allergies would make a really good opening way to open a conversation between parents and their children about, do they have these problems? Do their friends have these problems? How do you react if you see someone else dealing with this, and how to respond to them?
Next up, Perfect Strangers, Perfectos Desconocidos from Mexico, a comedy drama that's directed by Manolo Caro and written by Filippo Bologna and Paolo Castella. It's based on an Italian film of a couple years ago that Bologna and Castella did. Christy, what'd you think of Perfect Strangers?
So this is fun, and it has some snappy dialogue and some twists along the way. It's kind of soapy and juicy, and I enjoyed it. It is about a group of friends, several couples, and then one guy who shows up solo. And they have all known one another for a long time. They have plans to go on vacations together, and kids are friends, that kind of thing. And they meet at one couple's very opulent home for a dinner party. And as they get to talking, they all kind of complain about how we're so reliant on our phones and we constantly have our face in our phones and we should just all put our phones down. But let's play a game with it. Let's put our phones in the center of the table. And if anyone's phone pings with a text or an email or a Facebook notification, that person has to read the contents of it for the entire table. There are no secrets. Whatever comes up, it's fine. We don't have any secrets with each other, right? We all know each other very well. What do we have to hide? It'll be fun. It'll be mundane things about like dental appointments and kids' birthday parties and that
this
kind of thing.
This is always a terrible idea.
It is.
Yeah, it's
right?
Almost like putting your keys in for a wife swapping. Yeah.
There you go. This is like a phone swapping thing.
That's
so,
usually a terrible idea.
So it's it starts out in kind of a lighthearted way, some embarrassing things here and there, but then one guy realizes, okay, I'm going to get a photo from somebody and my wife can't know I'm getting it. So let's swap phones for a bit. You and I, who have the same phone, let's swap phones just for one half an hour or so. And that leads to a whole other series of misunderstandings because that guy has his own secrets on his phone. And it's light at first and then it gets darkly funny and then it just gets dark. And it's, in theory, it's an indictment of our over-reliance on our communications devices. You know, maybe we wouldn't have all these secrets if we didn't have the methodology for maintaining them, right?
Oh, sure. That's
so, maybe that's it. I will say that it gets really melodramatic and really over the top toward the end, and then it kind of pulls the rug out from underneath you. Oh. I can very easily imagine, not unlike the upside this week. I can very easily imagine an English language remake of this with a big cast.
Well, this is a real, I mean, that's really dancing on a razor's edge, all the different tonal kinds of switches that
yes.
Perfect Strangers undertakes. Mm-hmm. It's in selected theaters and unrated. Rust Creek, a thriller that's directed by Jen McGowan, written by Stu Pollard and Julie Lipson. Tim?
This is a resilient, clever girl who will kill you if you make her movie. But she doesn't want to kill you. And it's sort of a new genre. There's a little movie last year, I think, called Revenge. It was sort of the same thing. There have been two or three of them, right? You know, a young woman involved in a situation with these men and finds herself being tracked and stalked by these men and has to rise to the occasion, as she does. In this particular one, she's driving upstate. Her GPS takes her off a map. She ends up out in the middle of nowhere. These sort of hillbilly types, one of whom is played by a guy named Micah Hopman, who's very, very, very good. I like Micah. He's just wonderful. He's just playing this hillbilly. Scary as you ever wanted to see, and she tries to get away from him, ends up, you know, in a situation. Now, the movie here has way more story than it needs because we end up in this whole sort of meth cooking situation, and there's something going on with the sheriff and all of this. But she gets driven deeper and deeper into the woods until she decides, you know what, I'm not running anymore. And then it becomes one of those, I told you, I'd kill you if you made me.
You compare it to Revenge. Revenge has style.
Yeah.
This does not. This is pretty straightforward. This reminded me more of Winter's Bone. This is like a low-rent version of Winter's Bone, where we have this plucky young woman taking us into, like, the depths of hell in Kentucky meth country. I found the
Kentucky meth country.
It is.
I love that sentence.
It is. It's more interesting when it's about this slice of life in this place and time where people are just desperate and they're doing what they have to do to survive. She's not all that well developed as a character. We know from the beginning that she's a runner, and that serves her well in terms of her, you know, her resiliency, her resourcefulness, and her ability to fight back. But we don't really know a whole lot about her. I mean, she's got some intern she's driving to interview for, but, like, what's it even about? Like, what is she studying? Not a whole lot about her. So,
Hermione Corfield stars in the film Rust Creek. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. The Lithuanian-U.S. co-production Ashes in the Snow, romantic film starring Belle Powley and Martin Wallström. Marius Markovicius is the director, and Ben York Jones, the screenwriter. Christy.
This is about a segment of World War II that I really did not know a whole lot about. Did you, Tim?
No, not exactly. It's unremarkable, though, but I didn't know about this specifically.
About this specifically, I did not know. About under Stalin's regime, rounding up people and just sending them off to labor camps. And Belle Powley is a teenage girl in one such family in Lithuania. Mm. And she is 16, and she is a promising young artist, and she lives a comfortable, happy life with her family, and it's how they get swept up and ripped apart and how they survive. It is relentlessly bleak, but within that tonal bleakness, there is some really striking imagery, especially when they get to their ultimate destination, which is this labor camp in Siberia. Mm. Like, some of the widescreen shots of just the snow and the cloudy backdrop are really beautiful, but there's not a whole lot in terms of variance of tone, and I guess it's meant to be an inspiring story of survival.
Well, I suppose there's a little bit of a love story insinuated in there, in a certain sort of way. But yes, it's deeply moving, and depictions of the sort of man's inhumanity and all of that. We know from movies like Schindler's List and many, many others now. And in that way, it is unremarkable. And maybe that's me, because, you know, you've come to see these moments again and again and again in these movies where these, in this particular case, Russian soldiers are being brutal to these Lithuanians and killing them willy-nilly. And it can become numbing in a certain sort of way. So important, yes, but unremarkable.
But the young man in this is also the young man who finds the dog in A Dog's Way Home.
That's the timing.
In that way, it's remarkable.
That's a long trip for the dog.
Ashes in the Snow.
From 1941.
Lithuanian-U.S. co-production. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and it's unrated. Also screening at the Music Hall, The Aspern Papers, starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Vanessa Redgrave, Jolie Richardson. Julian Landes is the director of the film and co-screenwriter. Tim?
Debuting director, where there is a spinster, a rich spinster, and a young, handsome man, there will be a seduction. because that's just the way it works. It's particularly particularly in a Henry James novel, and this is based on a Henry James novel. There are 24 producers on this movie.
Oh, my God.
24.
And three countries involved.
Yeah. You know, including much of the cast. And James Ivory, of course, is one of the producers who, of course, made many Henry James adaptations. This isn't very good. But for the Redgrave family, Vanessa and Jolie, they have these moments where they get to do what they do, particularly Dame Vanessa, and they just eat the scenery. But everybody else, no.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is shockingly miscast in this. He's doing this very flat American accent, and he is awful. He's just really stiff. Like, he's somebody with a really dangerous kind of fascinating screen presence, which is so tamped down here. He does not get to do what makes him interesting here at all. He's never charming. He's never sly. But Vanessa, watching Vanessa and Jolie together is a nice, rare treat. It does not happen very often. Mm.
So we want to see that in future films that are better than, clearly.
Yes.
The Aspern Papers, based on the Henry James novel, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Vanessa Redgrave, Jolie Richardson star. It's at the Music Hall, Lemley Theater in Beverly Hills, and it's rated R. Coming up, Charles Solomon sticks around with me as we'll talk with Pete Docter of Pixar Animation, not just about the very latest developments at Pixar, but we'll also talk about the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who is being honored Saturday night by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association for his remarkable career. And he's working on a new film right now as well. So that's how productive and busy the giant of animation is. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Great to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. The Los Angeles Film Critics Association holds its annual awards dinner Saturday night in Century City. Its honorees have already been voted on and announced. Roma will receive the Best Picture Award. But every year, one of the highlights is LAFCA's Career Achievement Award. The previous recipients make up a who's who of cinema. This year, another giant of movies is being honored, director and animator Hayao Miyazaki. The co-director of Japan's Studio Ghibli has made some of the most acclaimed films in history. My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away, and Howl's Moving Castle. At age 77, he's working on a new feature, How Do You Live? Miyazaki isn't fluent in English, so we've invited two huge fans of his artistry, our Film Week critic Charles Solomon and the chief creative officer of Pixar Animation Studios, Pete Docter, himself, writer, director of great animated films like Inside Out and Up. Pete, Charles, good to have you both with us today.
Always glad to be
Thanks.
Here.
Charles, let me start with you, because you've spoken all these years on Film Week about reverence, probably is not an overstatement for how you feel about Miyazaki. Why is he so important as an artist?
Well, I think genius is a horribly overused word in our culture today, and I think the art of animation has really produced three. There was Winsor McCay, who basically created an art form out of nothing. Walt Disney, who completely re-envisioned what the art form was capable of, and now Miyazaki, who's given us yet another completely original vision of what animation can achieve. And if you go anywhere in the world, from Toulouse to Toronto to Tokyo, you talk to artists, they will all say, yes, Miyazaki is one of our major influences because his work is so good and so beautiful that everyone studies it and wants to learn from it.
Pete, one of the things that I'm struck by with every Miyazaki film I've ever seen is the way he's able to convey emotion without sentimentality. And I wonder if you can speak to that, how his movies are so compelling. I mean, you've had that kind of success with Up, certainly, where people were deeply touched by the film.
I cry every time I see it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, he has this amazing balance. And, you know, I don't think anyone could watch one of his films and say, those characters aren't enormously compelling and cute and appealing, and yet he'll also balance it with just enough kind of gross stuff or surprising, shocking elements to make you never quite know what you're going to get. And I think that's one of the joys of watching his films.
Well, I was also going to jump in and say that even in Spirited Away, probably his most celebrated film, the heroine, Chihiro, begins, she's sulky, she's petulant, she's skinny, she's frowning. But as she's put through trial, she discovers reservoirs of love and strength and courage that she didn't know she had, and neither did anyone else. And I think, Pete, that could also be said of some of your characters, that certainly neither Russell nor Carl in Up begin as the most prepossessing people in the world, yet you grow to love them as you see them grow and warm up.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I think, you know, one of the reasons, well, secretly, I think all animation directors want to be Miyazaki because he seems so self-possessed and confident in what he's saying. He seems like he puts forward these ideas just as concepts that are pretty far out, some of them. They're not easy sells to an audience, and yet they're so compelling and universal, and I think also subtle. You know, they're not overtly stated, oh, here's the character with the problem. You know, it's just, here, I'm on this journey, and I really don't know where this film is going. It's kind of unpredictable structurally.
Well, something else I think he does exceedingly well, and that you do too, Pete, is you silence, and you don't talk the audience to death. You know, I half joke that, yes, I cry whenever I see Up, but that montage that summarizes Carl and Ellie's life together would be so tedious and so unmoving if you talked through it, just as you don't need the two little girls talking when they're waiting for their father in Totoro. The visuals and the music just carry it, and you know what they're experiencing.
Well, thanks. We started with that sequence, making it a series of little cuts with dialogue and sound effects and everything. And as we developed it, we kept stripping away to the point where there's nothing other than music. If you watch it, there's not even sound effects. And I kind of feel like you connect deeper because it's asking the audience to participate. They have to kind of introduce their own ideas of what they're talking about or what sounds are going on. And so it becomes more real in your own head, I think.
Well,
and that's my pet theory.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Pete. The other thing is that for Miyazaki, when I think of his films and scenes that have really been powerful, they're often, there's no dialogue, but you'll hear little background, like little footsteps or the wind blowing the leaves. There's something, he's very gifted at how he uses sounds in his film. And I wonder, Pete, if that's something we think less about, but that is every bit as important in animation.
Oh, absolutely. And I think beyond the sound, just the importance of nature, things that if you were being very critical and you just needed to trim for time, you'd be like, I don't need this splash or this drop of water on a leaf or what, just get rid of that stuff. But no, that's I think what transports you. It makes you feel like you're in that forest, standing at the bus stop waiting along with the kids. You know, he has this ability to know what details to bring forward so that it just becomes more visceral and alive.
Well, yeah, and I would say in a lot of American animated films, you get the feeling you're being grabbed by the lapels and told you're having fun, whereas Miyazaki will show you a girl lying amid the flowers watching the clouds drift by, and he just sort of offers you his hand and said, here's a journey, let's go.
And it enables you to feel as though not just that you're there with her, but somehow you're inside her head. You're getting insight into how she experiences, not just how you would experience if you're laying in that same meadow. We're talking about the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who's being honored Saturday night in Century City by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. It's their Lifetime Achievement Award, the Career Achievement Award, that's gone to some of the giants of filmmaking, directors, actors, others who've been pioneers of global cinema. Miyazaki certainly standing standing at the top among the greats in global cinema for the work that he's done with all the terrific animated films. Charles, as someone who's very keyed into animation education, how is Miyazaki taught? Someone goes to art school or to animation school. How do you teach what he does? Is that possible?
Well, I don't think too many people need to be taught, as if you're an animation student, you come in sort of already steeped in Miyazaki. I remember when I was at, I taught a class at Chapman this semester, and when I showed, some of the students were asking about, well, had I been to Japan, had I talked to this, and I showed them a picture of me with Miyazaki, and they couldn't have been more impressed if I had been with the Shroud of Turin. what you can do is talk about, okay, here's an example, for example, in Totoro, of the two little girls meeting him. Then you can show them Hiccup and Toothless meeting in the first How to Train Your Dragon movie and say, okay, Dean has talked about how we learned from Miyazaki, and here's how to present this very complicated relationship silently but effectively and movingly.
We're talking about Hayao Miyazaki, the Japanese animator, who again is being honored Saturday night by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. And we'll continue our conversation with the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios, Pete Docter, the man who wrote, directed Up, Inside Out, and other Pixar favorites, part of the Brain Trust at Pixar. And we're going to talk with him as we continue about how that collaborative approach works at Pixar and how the other creative giant at Ghibli Studios in Tokyo also is a major player in the work of Hayao Miyazaki. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, and I sure hope to see you coming up on Sunday, February 17th, the afternoon event, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, our annual Academy Awards preview. Charles will be there with all of our Film Week critics on stage at the Ace. Tickets available, kpecc.org/in-person. We're back in just 1 minute. Such pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our animation critic Charles Solomon is joining me as we talk about the honoree for a Career Achievement Award by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animator who will be there to receive the honor. Oh, he won't be there. He's not coming?
No, he's 77 and in the middle of a film.
So he's not, all right, he's not breaking away.
No.
Okay. He will not be there, but in absentia will be honored. We're talking with Pete Docter as well, who's the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios, about Miyazaki's extraordinary body of work, its impact on animators. And as Charles said, he is working on yet another film. I thought he was going to retire, Charles.
He did retire. But when I first met him in 1999 with Princess Mononoke, he was saying, oh, I'm going to have to retire soon. I don't have as much energy. My eyes aren't as good as they used to be. And he's been talking about it ever since. He retired. He started a short film for the Ghibli Museum, where he makes shorts that are only shown there. He got a new crew of young computer artists who came in. He got excited and got an idea for a feature.
So here we are with yet another. I wanted to ask you, Pete Docter, about the teamwork in animation. We often see with animated films two, sometimes even three directors that are involved with making a film. We're aware of the Pixar Brain Trust, where the group of you all made your own films, but collaborate, give feedback on what each of you are doing. Isao Takahashi is the other great animator, part of Studio Ghibli. How important was he in influencing what Miyazaki was doing, and vice versa?
Well, I think they both admired and sort of saw things that they would do differently in each other's work. There were no secrets about. They had a little bit of a rivalry, but also a love for each other, I think. And each other's work. But there's a really interesting contrast, and I'm fascinated by this, in working methods between, I guess, what you'd call Western filmmaking, starting with Walt Disney, and the way those guys work. They are much more single-person focused. Now, it's an extreme to say that, because I think each individual animator does contribute in very meaningful ways, and they help shape the sequences. But just as a as an example, we have a team of anywhere from 6 to 10, 12 story artists, right, who help us create the story and the outline for the film, what's going to happen. Miyazaki boards the whole thing himself. He is the only story artist. And when he visited Pixar a number of years back, we told him this, and he kind of shook his head and said, if I could only figure out how to do that, that he would prefer – he said he'd prefer to have a bunch of story artists because it's a lot of work. But it's just a very different kind of a way of working. I think some of it's cultural. Some of it's the fact that he grew up in television, and that was where he kind of cut his teeth, that they really do rely on these key figurehead artists to drive a lot of this stuff.
Well, also, when you look at Miyazaki's storyboards, he's pretty much made the whole film. All the expressions are there, camera movements are there, notes on the animation are there.
Yeah.
You know, are you that thorough when you're boarding, Pete?
Well, you could say there are some sequences that if you go back and look at the storyboards, you know, the sequence we were talking about in Up, Married Life, that is almost shot for shot what Ronnie Del Carmen boarded. But it's a very communal, collaborative effort for us. And I think it is for them, too, but not to the same degree that we the way we work. Even when you go back in history, and Charles and I are both very fascinated by Disney history, and Walt is certainly a singular voice, had strong opinions about things, knew down to detailed like ink lines on characters in Snow White. He knew everything of what was going on. But even he, I think, was less sort of directly the auteur of the films that Miyazaki is. Would you agree with that, Charles?
Oh, yeah, because he also had crews, and you were talking, Pete, about how the animators contribute. In the new documentary, Neverending Man, there's, I think, a really revealing sequence when Miyazaki gets mad at an animator and tells him, you're drawing people, not just characters.
Yeah.
Pete,
which is similar than – sorry.
No, finish your point, please.
I was just going to say that's very similar to the way we think, and I know Walt Disney thinks, that these characters become very real. They become like people that you know, and they can complete their own sentences, and they come alive in your head. And I think that's one of the keys to his great work, is that he does think of them as real people. He bases it, I got to believe, on just really second-to-none observation, things that he's seen, details, behaviors, the way a little kid eats soup, or you know, just simple things, how they won't just stand still. They're like scratching their leg with their other leg, or, you know, these amazing details that are what really bring it to life and make those characters so real.
I wanted to ask you, Pete, also about just Pixar, because you've had so much change over the course of the past year with John Lasseter, the founder, leaving the company, co-founder Ed Catmull announcing he's going to be stepping down next year. You're taking over the creative leadership of Pixar, Jennifer Lee, who co-directed Frozen, a Disney animation. Things at Pixar were so stable for so long. Now you've got all these big changes. How was the staff digested all that?
Yeah, we were really spoiled. The sort of stability doesn't happen often in Hollywood, much less the world. But yeah, I think the amazing thing now is we have this amazing, there's great opportunity to bring new voices to the table. We have 10 films at Pixar in varying stages of all the way from production to development. And most of them are new directors, people that you haven't seen before, that are going to come bringing their own perspectives of where they came from and the way they look at life. And that's, I feel like, the key to our creative ongoing legacy, is to bring forth new stuff, surprise people.
Well, you know, along those lines, you're working on Toy Story 4. You've got three critically acclaimed films that precede it. And, you know, I've just heard anecdotally from some people who say, well, why, you know, you're 3 for 3. Why take on the risk of a fourth? And is that going to the well too often? How do you respond to that skepticism?
Well, those characters are strangely really giving in a lot of different angles and dimensions. And so we've had a really good time. It's not been easy. This has been a tough one. But they all are, you know, exploring other sides of Woody and some of the other characters that you haven't seen before. So I hope we'll surprise you with this one.
We're talking with Pete Docter, who's the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios. Joining us from Pixar, Charles Solomon, our animation and film critic for Film Week, joining us in our Film Week studios. As we talk about the L.A. Film Critics Association Saturday night in Century City, honoring with their Career Achievement Award the great Japanese animator, filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki, who's getting the Career Achievement Award in absentia for his terrific work and yet at work on another feature film. Charles, just in closing, quick thing for us to think about Miyazaki and his legacy.
He's simply better than anybody else working today, which is why everybody admires him and is influenced by him.
All right. Charles, thank you so much. Pete, a pleasure. Thank you, and wish you all the
best
at Pixar. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, we remind you that our Film Week Academy Awards preview is coming up Sunday afternoon, February 17th, just a week before the Oscars. Great chance for you to see all of our critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll show clips of the Oscar-nominated films. It's a great time. Last year sold out. Get your tickets now. KPECC.org/in-person. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.